listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Now onwards to tonight's program, Lewis Hyde and Peter Sellers discussing Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership, in which we may learn what are the distinctions between discovery and invention, and why is that important? What was the original purpose of the idea of copyright? For what length of time, Thomas Jefferson pondered, should the living be given their dominion? With no solution in sight, you know, to the great, wonderful mess of the internet, the great puzzles, are we, as Grateful Dead lyricist Perry Barlow once feared, quote, sailing into the future on a sinking ship? The purpose of his ingenious new book, Common as Air, put most simply, Lewis Hyde says, is not to debate policy. It is rather to enlarge the set of stories that might usefully guide our thinking about the ownership of art and ideas. And that's a task to which Lewis Hyde, who is a poet, a translator, a philosopher, and scholar, has long applied himself to the great enrichment of the common good. You'll find his book, The Gift, his groundbreaking and influential study of creativity, on the shelves of creative and curious people everywhere in the 80s and probably up to this day. I know that artists exchange dog-eared, marked-up copies among each other. And it's a book that you want to pass on to someone else that you care about, someone who's interested in ideas and art. Hyde's second book, Trickster Makes This World, is a marvelous cross-cultural study of the mischievous mythological trickster figure. It mixes up Duchamp and Ginsberg with literary strands from West Africa, India, and China. So tonight, Lewis Hyde, a MacArthur Fellow, former director of creative writing at Harvard, and Richard L. Thomas, professor of creative writing at Kenyon College, we'll discuss the cultural commons with another uncommon thinker and artist, Peter Sellers. Peter is also a MacArthur Fellow. He's a renowned theater, opera, and festival director, and as well a generous and outspoken cultural activist, quite a beloved part of this community. Peter's known for his innovative interpretations of classic works, his innovative collaborations with composers like John Adams, his creative stewardship of international arts and film festivals. But I won't go into a list of his many, many wonderful projects and long list of awards because knowing Peter, I'm sure he would much rather exchange ideas and take that time to mix it up with Lewis Hyde and with you. We'll take your questions at the end of their conversation. A microphone, one of our staff, or two of them, I believe, will be passing a microphone around. So please wait until the microphone comes to you as we do record for podcast. And Lewis will be signing his books in the lobby afterwards. So please join us there. And now please join me in welcoming Lewis Hyde and Peter Sellers to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming over. Nice to see everyone here. You've had a lot of introductions. I'll just do a little one more little one just to say, of course, Lewis's book, The Gift, was a big moment in a lot of people's lives, and Lewis writes books that are extremely subtle, intricate, finely woven. There have been three books across a lifetime, three main books, and when somebody writes a book year in, year out, you don't get so much time shifting. Whereas these three books that Lewis has written, each book is written for generations to come. And we get to be here while he's writing them. And they're addressed to the biggest possible questions with the quietest possible thought process. The books don't run around. They don't try and impress you. They're extremely, extremely quiet and thoughtful.
I just think of myself as a very slow writer, but I love the way Peter describes it.
And I have to say, it's just And you have to read them really slowly. It takes me a long time to read one of Lewis's books, and I do have to kind of double back and say, no, I don't think I got that. I have to go back and start again. And it's just a pleasure when we're in the presence of so much kind of fast food and instant everything to have something that was not microwaved into existence, but really came cooked the slow way where those flavors are in there. So just to say, the next book is here, Common as Air. And in this age of mass privatization, where everything possible that was public and what made America amazing was its public character, has been or is being privatized. Lewis has made a very powerful book that starts with intellectual copyright and the questions of intellectual property, which of course have been advanced by teams of super evil lawyers operating in zip codes very close to this one. The movie industry once again took the lead, but obviously the food industry and so on are not far behind. But what we're talking about is the commons. What is common? What don't we have to pay for? And if we don't have to pay for it, is there a secret charge, which is called responsibility? And what does it mean to take care of something that you don't have to pay for and not think of something that, you know, the money gives you permission to not care about it because you bought it. So, but what it means when it's actually only kept alive because you care for it and not because it's part of some other monetary exchange. Lewis has done one really shocking thing in this book, which is... this is an age where we need to hear more rhetoric about the incredible founding fathers of this country and what they would actually wish. Actually, Lewis decided that would be a very good idea. What would they wish? And the book is focused on a first vision of America as something that didn't exist in the world before by people who mistrusted any kind of absolute power. And we're looking for a contested area where speech could be free, not just that you could say anything, but you could say difficult things. And that place of difficulty was maintained on behalf of everyone. Would you maybe talk about maintaining a space of difficulty in order to taste and test your freedom?
Well, actually, even... more than maintaining is learning to enjoy a space of difficulty. So actually, I tell the story of Rip Van Winkle in the book, who falls asleep actually before the American Revolution, and it's a kind of quiet, mundane world, and he wakes up after the American Revolution, and everybody's arguing, and they want to know what political party he belongs to. And this is the news. And the news is that... part of what American democracy was, I think, at the beginning, was an experiment in public argument, in what some people call agonistic pluralism. So I didn't know we were going to start with this, but it nicely fits with theater directing, because the word agon, A-G-O-N, has two uses in ancient Greek. One is it's about contests in sports on the field, and then it also is a particular event in drama in which characters on the stage argue, but nobody is the hero. So you in the audience have to entertain plural speech and hear an argument whose conclusion is not obvious. And so agonism is a kind of fighting. This comes out of, there's a wonderful essay by Adam Phillips, the British analyst. He has an essay called Superiorities in a book called Equals. And he develops this from other people, but he says that there's an important distinction between agonism, which is this fighting, and antagonism, which is fighting where you actually want to kill your enemy. So there would be an ideal of a public debate in which you were not simply trying to suppress the opponent, but in fact let things flow. And the example I use actually is Benjamin Franklin in the autobiography tells a story about this guy named Whitefield, who is a Methodist preacher, and comes to Philadelphia. And at first the local ministers let him use their pulpits, but they didn't agree with Whitefield, so they stopped letting him use their pulpits. And so he began to preach in the fields and streets of Philadelphia. And Franklin says that he and his friends thought this was wrong, that there should be some place to entertain even this other voice. And they built a building, 50 feet by 100 feet or something like this. And Franklin says, the point of this building was that anybody could come and speak to the people of Philadelphia, even if the Mufti of Constantinople wished to come and convert us to Mohammedism, he would have a pulpit in Philadelphia. And you do have to wonder if that had, you know, if we'd had 200 years of clearly articulated Muslim speech in this country, we might not be in the fix we're in today. But it is an image of public argument, but also of if you are the citizen who goes into this hall, on the one hand you would say this is about freedom of speech, that anybody can come and speak. So that's true. But if you flip it and don't think about the speaker but about the listener, it's about freedom of listening. And how do you create a space where you have freedom to listen, and particularly where you can listen to plural voices so that you are in the space of multiple discourses and then are in the position of trying to figure out what the answer is. And in this model, you would say that the job of leaders in democracy is not to lead us, but to help create spaces for plural listening and to keep the noise low enough that we can hear each other.
There are these unexpected, your book has these unexpected views of practices that we've now come to see as rather coercive. For example, corporate ownership of material and suits immediately for anything the Disney Corporation doesn't agree that you do with their stuff. A bunch of their stuff, of course, a bunch of their big Disney things coming from the public domain originally and then reclassified and rebranded and sent out there as corporate product. But copyright itself was imagined another way by the people who founded this country. Would you just talk a little bit about that and what the hope was?
Yeah, so, you know, here's the 22-second summary of the history of this. the American founders learned this tradition from England. And in England, the key moment had been, in the 17th century, the British crown controlled the press. And in fact, all over Europe, as printing arose, the government wanted to control it. And the way they controlled it in England was to have a group of people called the Stationers' Company who had monopoly privileges to print certain books. And this was a way to make sure there was no sedition or blasphemy or heresy. And so if you want a unified country where everybody's on the same page, you have a monopoly power over the page itself. And what happens around at the beginning of the 18th century is the slow change in which publishing houses and authors, it was actually more publishing houses at the beginning, are allowed to own their own work. And we get the first copyright law, which is called the Statute of Anne. And let me say two or three things about it. One was, it put a limit on the term of ownership, which was unique. That is, before this time, monopolies were perpetual. If you had the right to print the Bible in England, nobody ever could take it away from you. So the idea of limiting it to 14 or 28 years or whatever is radical. Secondly, you had to ask for the privilege. It was understood to be a privilege created by statute, not a natural right. And so you had to raise your hand and say, I'd like to have a copyright, and, you know, here's my sixpence, and they would give it to you. But the sort of invisible consequence of this is it brought the public domain into being. Because when you have an end to the term, then things fall into the cultural commons. And, you know, Daniel Defoe's novels after 28 years belong to everybody because nobody owns them. And secondly, the registration requirement creates a public domain because actually many people don't care to own their work and so don't raise their hand and ask for the privilege. And just to jump then to the present, and then I'll go back briefly to the founders, I mean, two things we've done, as you probably all know, is one is to extend the term radically. So now corporations get 95 years. I get my life plus 70 years if I live to be a long, you know. It is almost statistically a perpetual right that we now give. And secondly, we've done away with the registration requirement. So if you're taking notes at this, or if you have a grocery list in your pocket, you own it under American copyright law. And somebody using it without your permission could technically be sued. And this is crazy. to come back to the founders, though, the key piece of this for the founders was the monopoly problem. So they had understood that the control of the press in England before the Statute of Anne was not only monopoly, but monopoly was the way you controlled expression. This was how you kept people from saying things you didn't want them to say. And actually, I quote this letter of John Locke's. Locke is thought of as somebody who famously supports property rights. But when it came to printing, he did not. And he said, you know, the idea of giving perpetual rights to people is just there to keep the church from being insulted. We need, you know, we need the freedom to insult the church. So monopoly privilege for the founders was a dangerous thing because it would be the way you suppress political and religious discourse. And Jefferson actually thought that there should be a prohibition in the Bill of Rights on all monopolies. And he changed his mind later. But that sort of is a marker out in the far field of you know, the danger they thought. So when they, in the Constitution, when they say, okay, we can give a limited right, the word limited was very important to them because the limitation means both you get the public domain and also you avoid the problem of ongoing monopoly. And
would you just now talk about just a bit, bring us up to the Disney Corporation for a moment.
Well, I love Walt Disney. And well, I have an example in the book. There was a Russian artist named Mikhail Chamyaykin who was raised in Russia and did not get along with the Soviet authorities who wanted him to do a particular kind of art and came to this country and lived in Los Angeles for a while. And I corresponded with this guy. He now lives in Paris, the place between America and Russia. What he actually said was that he was frustrated with how little people knew about Russian iconography in his paintings, and he constantly had to explain things. So he did a painting once, which he thought he would not have to explain, and it's Mickey Mouse handing a can of Campbell's soup to a Russian aristocrat. You know, it's a whimsical little pastel. But it was in his gallery here in L.A., and the Disney people came and said, you can't use that. You have to take it down. And they actually had to cover it up with brown paper during the show, and he was not allowed to make copies of it after that. So it's it's a simple example of the fact that monopoly privileges can be used. You know, we talk about this as incentivizing, and of course it does. My book is copyrighted. I get royalties. I'm happy about that. I'm not against copyright. But the incentive to produce is only one of the incentives you create when you give this monopoly privilege. You also create the incentive to bully and to do other things. And I should say, in this case, Chamyaykin could have won a fair use case. Under copyright law, he could have gone to court and pushed back against Disney. But you can't do it. It's the numbers are prohibitive if you want to actually win a fair use case.
Would you, one of the powerful things is to have the story of Benjamin Franklin as a scientist, as somebody who really chooses not to patent his inventions and says, you know, oh, by the way, sending letters to friends saying, this is my latest experiment, these are the results, and anyone you think would be interested in this, you should please share it with them. Would you talk about that attitude towards science and how, as a scientist, he influenced, or at least wanted to have some influence over the way patenting works. And then meanwhile, what it means that you really do conceive your work for the public.
You know, I take off a remark of Ralph Waldo Emerson's. And he has this essay called Self-Reliance, and if you're in a glum mood one morning, read that and it'll help you get out of bed. But in Self-Reliance, you know, Emerson's essay is an early intervention in the creation of American individualism. And he asks rhetorically, where is the master who could have taught Benjamin Franklin? And we're supposed to think, well, nobody could have. He's a unique. He's an amazing person. But if you really know Franklin's story, it becomes clear it's not true, and also Franklin never presented himself that way. What Franklin was an incredible absorber of the world around him. I think of him actually as that the model of the mind here is, it's the mind of a host, of somebody who is a great welcomer of other people's ideas. And so, for example, the story about patenting is about the wood stove. So he invents a wood stove. But he doesn't invent a wood stove. What he does is to combine other people's ideas. And he publishes a pamphlet, explains how the stove is made. But in the pamphlet, you see that he's drawn on six different books he's read about how to make wood stoves out of France and England and Germany and so forth. And he also knows Newton and Boyle. Franklin thought that the invention he'd come up with was a stove. He called it a siphon in reverse, in which hot air would go down. But he knows about the circulation of hot fluids because he's been studying physics that's come out of England. So, he's swimming in a sea of ideas, and then he is a genius, but it's the genius of somebody who is first of all a host and then knows how to remake things. So there are two remarks about patent, and the one that's famous is he says, you know, we are so indebted to the things that we have received from the past that we should be happy to give things away to the future. The other place he says, a second thing about this is, in terms of scientific ideas, you know, the ethic in science often is, this experiment is not about me. Should be able to replicate it, whoever does it, and if it's just the way I did it, then it's not a scientific truth. And so Franklin says, I don't defend my ideas. You know, when he publishes his theories of electricity, he says, if they're wrong, then they should be argued with and knocked down. And then he says, I have never taken an ownership in my ideas. To do so would sour the temper. And it's a wonderful image of that his delight would be in the conversation of science, whose goal is to find the truth, not to inflate the ego. And that to own an idea in the sense of trying to defend it against contrary evidence would be a spiritual mistake.
Would you talk more about the presence of the ego in your book? you really move into major ego space.
Well, what are you thinking about? There's many...
Well, it keeps coming up over and over and over again. And again, this question of the self. What is the self? What is the creative self? Obviously, that comes very deep already in the gift, but would you...
Well, in a way, I think you can track the rise of the ownership of art and ideas with the rise of an ideology of individualism. And there is a big puzzle about where any invention comes from. And this is not to say that there aren't inventive people and great minds and great artists, but that even those people, you have to ask where their talent came from and also what they swam in as they made their work. And so, I have a lot of examples from older cultures of people who would have been astounded that you could own things. I mean, the tradition in China, for example, for centuries was that you as an artist or poet were working with truths that came from the spiritual world and you were more like a servant of them. And I quote a 14th century Chinese poet who says, if the forgers should find something of use in my poems, what do I have to grudge? And this is not what you read in the FBI warnings. we should do a parody FBI. so there's a long tradition in which people understood that the individual contribution to any creative thing was there, but also was not the whole thing. And so I do try to revisit this sense of what makes a creative person and how do we imagine ourselves creatively. I guess one of my favorite quotations is somebody late in life asks Goethe, the poet, to talk about his own work. And he says, well, my work has come from old people and young people and dunces and wise people and gypsies and whatever. And he has this long list. And he says, my work is the work of a collective being that bears the name of Goethe. I love that image of to conceive of yourself as a collective being. And part of the argument of this book is that the way we set up our protocols around around property enable or disable certain ways of being human. And to come back to the founding generation, one of the ways of being human that mattered to them was to enable people to acquire a thing called civic virtue. I don't know if you've heard about this, but it's civic virtue is the virtue you acquire by public action. And you can't acquire this virtue unless you're enabled to do public action. And so if your property regimes make it more difficult to do this, then you can't be this kind of person. And I do some material with a scientist and with different artists in this line.
Would you talk about John Adams' bridge in that direction?
Yeah, so I illustrate some of this with a story about John Adams. And in the background is a question. In the 18th century, people thought of themselves as engaged in what used to be called civic republicanism, in which the Republican ideal at that time was not against private property. It was understood that it was very important that people have independent means and be able to stand on their own. And so this is an anti-feudal, you know, sort of moving out of feudalism and a rise of a kind of proto-modern individualism. But then the puzzle is, so now that you have a freelance and you're a free man, why are you, what is your freedom for? And the answer at that time was, you're a propertied person such that you can enter the public sphere and do things for your community. And the story about Adams was, when his father dies, he inherits a farm in Quincy, Massachusetts, and as a landowner becomes part of the community, of the governing body of the town. And they ask him to be in charge of repairing a bridge. And Adam says, I don't know anything about repairing bridges. And they say, well, you have to learn that. And so he does. And it's what I call the Republican two-step. That is to say, once you are empowered as a civic actor, then you have duties. And the duties are to the public good. And I think, actually, that the earliest copyright regime in this country was based on the Republican two-step. That is to say, it gives a short-term individual monopoly privilege. It says, yes, you made this, and you can have it, and you can get income from it. But it also says there's an end to that, such that these things go into the public domain. Another way of saying this is one thing that was on the mind of the founders was the way inheritance worked in Europe. And their understanding was that the way the aristocracy maintained their power was to inherit land generation after generation, a thing called entail. And so they said, we can't do that. We have to break up inheritance if we want to break up power. If we want power to be dispersed among the population, you can't have perpetual inheritance forms. And so in a funny way, you could think of the short-term copyright as a revision of inheritance in which I get to own my work for whatever number of years, and then the public inherits it. It becomes the property of all.
There's a really explosive chapter. This book is written with such refinement and grace, and you just want to savor and stop and just linger over a sentence, because Lewis is the most delicate and finely honed writer. In the middle of this book, which has thick, thick legal developments, arguments, philosophical questions, but always phenomenal stories, there's a chapter that does feel for me like a whale suddenly leaping out of the ocean, which is three shocking images. One is genetic research and contrasting the Genome Project and the privatization, public version and the private version. And I'm wondering if you would be willing to give us a thumbnail of that. And then there's an astounding meditation on Bob Dylan and the first however many songs that would not be...
Yeah, first 70 songs.
First 70 songs, which would never be admitted under copyright, and that the Times the Heritage Engine is based on a Scottish tune from the 1850s, and, you know, an entire body of work that would not exist today if our current standards were applied. And then finally, the copyright and intellectual property on Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, that means anyone discussing civil rights will be sued, and anyone who wants to use it for a cheesy phone ad can just pay up.
So this is a 40-page chapter. I don't know if you're ready for this.
Just to give them a few images, because this chapter is just a stunner.
Actually, I'll tell you something that's not in the book that I read recently that is related to... So there's a section about a man named John Sulston, who was one of the leaders of the public portion of the Human Genome Project, a scientist from England, won the Nobel Prize. And Sulston's argument about if you need to do complex science at that level, you need to treat the data as a common asset, and that's the only way to do it, to do pure science. And but the thing, I was thinking about this in the middle of last, a month or so ago in August, there's a piece in the New York Times about research being done on what are called biomarkers for Alzheimer's. And the point of the article was that this also is a very complicated problem, and that the turf in which it was being approached is all chopped up. You have industry researchers, you have academic researchers, you have the National Institute of Health, and so forth and so on. And people could not proceed with the work because they couldn't because the thing is complicated. And essentially, 7 years ago, some guys got together and said, "We gotta." And the line in the new article is: "It says we must leave our IP noses outside the door." And so they agreed to share all data on a daily basis worldwide. So anybody in industry, public research, government research, working on biomarkers for Alzheimer's, posted their data on the internet daily. And so everybody was working with the same data set. And the payoff is that 7 years later, they really begin to make progress on describing these, trying to find early stages such that you could begin to understand how this disease works. And so there's a lot of, go back to this question about enabling or disabling. To the degree that you have what's called a patent thicket, that is, everybody is concerned, first of all, with the proprietary nature of their research, you can't do this kind of science. You cannot be the scientist that John Sulston was if under certain property regimes, and you can be under others. So that's a little thumbnail of the...
Wow. Would you talk about the private version just finally lifting a bunch of the public research? And
about which? The
Yes.
Well, so there... You know, it got set up in this country as if there were a race between publicly funded research into the genome and private groups, particularly a group named Celera, I think it is. And it looked as if they had tied. They both published their work basically on the same day, one in Nature, one in Science. But the more you look at what they'd done is that the private research basically... was parasitical on the public research. They couldn't have done it without the public research. And also, they weren't doing pure science. They were really looking for targets. They were looking for pieces of the genome which would be money producers. And, you know, there is... So, you know, that's one way to do science. But another way is what's called Baconian science, in which you say, look, this is something fascinating, important, and mysterious, and we're going to try to understand it in its full complexity, including the parts of the genome that seem to be dead matter. We don't know why there are all these strips of in the genome that don't do anything, but we're going to ascribe them to. That's pure science, and you don't know if you'll ever make money off it. And so, you know, you had these two tracks, and you do a better job if you have a cultural commons.
Would you say a word for Bob Dylan in that regard?
Well, the thing I love about Dylan's book called Chronicles, which, you know, is just a sweet autobiographical narrative of his youth. And when he gets to...
it's also a really fantastic torture narrative also. I mean, for me, the tortured New Orleans chapter is also pretty cool.
Yes. My book is not about torture. when Dylan first, well, here I'll tell you the one that the phrase that sticks in my, you know, he learned from everybody else. The story everybody says about Dylan when he was 19 and 18 and so forth was that he was a sponge, that he was a blotter. This is literally the way it be, a sponge and a half, says Liam Clancy. You know, he was absorbing this world around him. And so when he first goes to New York, John Hammond gives him the first acetate printings of the old Robert Johnson recordings, which had just been bought by Columbia. And Dylan says, you know, he sat in his one-room apartment and listened to that record over and over and over again, writing it down, trying to figure out how Johnson did it. I mean, you have the sense of this incredibly studious kid. My analogy is he's like a farm kid who takes a tractor apart and puts it back together six times, and then he knows how a tractor works. So Dylan does this with music. And what happened earlier was he was in Minneapolis, and friends gave him all these early 78 RPM records of Woody Guthrie. And again, he says, I listened to all those records over and over again. They made me feel more like myself than ever before. I could sing every one of those songs. You know, I said, so this is how the game is played, and so forth. And he has story after story about this, of sort of being brought into art by art itself. The phrase in that thing about Guthrie that haunts me is when he says, listening to Woody Guthrie made me feel more like myself than ever before. So that, to me, that's a great puzzle. What is the self? Such that you're 18 years old, you come across a great artist, and suddenly you are yourself. Isn't that strange? I mean, so the self is clearly not about you, or it's about you and all this other stuff. And what a thing if you could then go on and be the kind of artist who other kids coming up would think, wow, I could do that. I see that this is a possible world, and maybe I have the the talents that I could fill out in this way. So.
Would you just lay out the I Have a Dream debacle?
So, you know, Martin Luther King's estate is run by his family, particularly by his son, Dexter King. And as far as I can see, Dexter King has commercialized the estate. And they've gone after people who USA Today printed the whole text of the I Have a Dream speech on Martin Luther King Day 1 year, and the King estate sued them for copyright infringement. And scholars are regularly discouraged from working with the King material. And you would think sometimes the heirs of a literary or cultural estate like this are doing it to protect the reputation of the person involved. But with the King estate, it's clearly not that, because they have sold rights to the King's material to advertisers. There's a famous Alcatel advertisement in which you see King all alone giving a speech, and then it comes in a voice that says, Alcatel, the company that will connect you to people, and then suddenly the crowd appears. I mean, it's disgusting. You know, what I actually do with this is I'm interested in sort of categories of social life and the need to keep them distinct such that they can retain their dignity. And so I get this partly from a famous book of Michael Walzer called Spheres of Justice. And Walzer says, look, you have the military, you have academy, you have the church, you have family, you have the marketplace, and each of these is appropriate in its own realm, and each of it has its own norms. But a simple definition of tyranny, which he takes out of Pascal, is when one of these realms begins to dominate others. And of course, the worst kind of tyranny in this century has been state tyranny, in which the government begins to dominate the market, the military, the church. So there are all kinds of tyranny. In this case, what you see is a great confusion on the part, I think, of King's heirs between King as a spiritual political leader and King as a commercial entity. And those are two different realms, and in their proper place, there's nothing wrong with commerce. But to take somebody who gave his life the way King did for those high ideals which were public and spiritual, and to make his work into a chattel is, I think it's a form of patricide on the part of his son.
These books that you've written are the books of somebody who is writing past the bad news that's accumulating day by day. You have a much longer view of where this country might be able to go and where this world might be able to go. Would you just talk a little bit about that place you write from?
Gosh. You know, I don't even know, to tell you some. I mean, I suppose when I was a kid, in college, there were people who'd given their lives to certain kinds of practice, and they mattered to me. And but it's almost like the Dylan thing, you know, how do you, so they do matter to you, and then you try to speak clearly from that source. I mean, oddly, this book actually began with a kind of pissed offness on my part. I have this early book on gift exchange, and so I sometimes get asked to talk about funding the arts. How do we support artistic practice in America? And so 15 years ago, I was giving such a talk, and one idea that was in play was, well, maybe, you know, the way we support the arts in this country is either the public purse or philanthropy from private foundations. So these are good models, but I think we haven't yet figured out how to do democratic patronage. You know, how to, I think that the fact is that the arts do not, they're not moneymakers. And so you need, if you value them, you have to figure out some way to support them. And I got interested in a kind of say, well, look, there's wealth in the artistic community already. Is there some way to recycle that wealth, to take the wealth that we create as artists and feed it back in such that the coming up generation can be supported, particularly in those years between 20 and 30 when you can't make a dime and you don't know if you're going to survive. And, you know, we need, so, and an idea had been proposed that maybe we could take the term of copyright and extend it for 20 years or something like this. And instead of having the money go back to the original rights holders, have it go into a public pot, some kind of a trust fund, and use that to support emerging artists. I know that was a kind of cunning idea because it says, look, there's wealth in the arts and let's use it to support the arts. So, you know, there's arguments on both sides of that idea. But what happened was I was writing this up and it turned out that the entertainment industry in this country was proposing to Congress to extend the term of copyright for 20 years and to do it retroactively so that things from the 1920s would be tied up. And as far as I could tell, for no public benefit. And it turns out when you go to Congress with an idea like this and a dollar in your hand, you can get a lot of votes. And so this passed, and it just seemed to me so egregious. And more than that, it seemed to me upsetting that the benefit of having a public domain, this was a literal taking from the public domain. 20 years of the public domain was enclosed, was fenced off by statute. And the analogy is in the 19th century in Europe, you couldn't destroy the agricultural commons because commoners wouldn't let you. You had to go to Parliament and change the rules. So this was like parliamentary enclosure for culture. And what distressed me was how little argument there was. It was very difficult to get anybody to see that this was worth talking about. And so I suppose where you get angry is one of the places where you know who you are. So,
but you said you didn't write a book about torture. I mean, to me, but you've always digested things so deeply before you offer them back as sentences. And so these sentences carry light. They carry so much life force and so much kindness in them, even though you're writing about very painful things.
I wish he would come with me whenever I talk. Well, thank you.
No, but I mean, you know, again, it's if I mean, the current cliche is angry, you know, and it's not an angry book. I mean,
well, I guess I would say the
anger was a trigger. Okay, but this is not an angry book. This is a book that goes way deeper than that.
Yeah, because I don't think anger is a good. I don't think it has staying power. And in a way, you know, at the end of the book, I'm not out of sympathy with the entertainment industry or the record companies. I mean, I think they have a real problem with digital downloading and so forth. But but my attempt is to deepen this conversation. In a sense, the point of this book is, look, for centuries the understanding was that cultural things like songs and myths and scientific ideas cannot be owned. They're not a kind of property. And it comes from an old sense that property is where you can exclude somebody. So I own a house, it's mine, because I can keep you out of it. And ideas are by nature non-excludable. And so so you begin with the default case that culture is itself a commons. And this was understood for, you know, 40,000 years, or however it is since the cave up to the 1710. And then you say, well, let's actually enclose a piece of this for some public good. And I think the Statute of Anne was a good idea. But then you have to say, well, what is the reason we're doing this? Why are we doing this? And so part of the point of this book is to go back to the founding generation and try to understand what they thought were the good reasons to do this. And on their minds were issues like democratic self-governance. How do you have a nation where people will be informed enough to vote and have public debate? On their minds were scientific community and community creative community in general. And on their minds were questions about public personhood. And if these are the ends you're headed for, then you need to interrogate the way you're rewriting your property laws to see if they're still serving these ends.
Deepening the conversation, the microphones, please. Here's already somebody right here who's ready.
It occurred to me to wonder if your ideas of enclosure and appropriation of the public to the private had dwelled at all on bandwidth and airwaves.
Well, yes and no. I mean, my book is not particularly about either the internet or the question about airwaves, but
there are spectacular internet moments in that book.
Well, you know, the sort of guiding language in the book is about the commons, and the fact is that so this language comes out of the old agricultural systems in Europe, where people had common use rights in fields and streams and so forth. But this has turned out to be a very useful set of metaphors and ways of thinking in many realms. And I'm trying in this book to talk really about intangible cultural products. But but others are working and doing good work on questions about the degree to which the internet should be treated as a commons and the degree to which public airwaves, you know, you can look back at the history of this and say, gosh, this is a fabulous, unowned natural fact that we can put radio waves through the air, and how shall we now treat it such that we have the public good? And but I'm not, I don't think that I have anything really useful to say on this tonight.
Yes, over here.
This is Rick, thank you. Thank you for this very enlightening conversation. There's two things I want to say. One is I was on my way over here listening on the radio about how the public was confusing the recent TARP legislation and the stimulus package and so on and so forth. And it just seems that in the public debate right now, there's confusion. You were just speaking about how can you have public discourse? You know, the point of democracy is that people are informed. Yeah. But it just seems that there's this cloud of confusion that keeps being put on on the public, so that they can't think and they can't, you know. And it's interesting when people talk about who they're going to vote for, it just is reducing. Well, I don't like this the way this guy looks, or I don't like, you know. So I just see that trend going more and more. So I wonder if you have any thoughts or comments about that. But another point. At the beginning of your speech, you mentioned the importance of a place where people could speak and people could be heard in Philadelphia, I believe.
Yeah.
And today, Iranian President Ahmadinejad, you know, spoke at the United States General Assembly, and he gave UN General Assembly, I'm sorry. And he said his theories for 9/11, which prompted the United States ambassador to the UN to walk out and leave. And so I was just curious that, you know, in this form, which is the United Nations General Assembly, where you should be able to hear everything, that the ambassador of the U.S. is not able to hear that. I'm just wondering your thoughts about that.
I mean, Ahmadinejad's theory is that this was a conspiracy on the part of the United States or something, right? Well, he's nuts, and I would have walked out too. You know, plural listening does not mean you have to listen to bullshit. I mean, the flip of this, though, is, you know, the Bush administration was just egregious in denying visas to people who might want to come to this country and have a more informed discussion of things that happened related to the war on terror and so forth. You know, as for, you know, in the 18th century, there was a great hope of a public sphere of rational discourse, which I think is has been hard to maintain, and partly because I don't think they took into account the degree to which particularly the mass media are able to inject emotional tone into what is supposed to be rational discourse. To say one thing, though, more specifically about the topic of this book, again, the monopoly privilege of copyright was understood to give people some control over expression, and they were very wary of what they called negative voice. In England, the crown had the negative voice, which is to say, essentially a veto power over anything the parliament did. And the thought in England was, if somebody can veto what the parliament does, then you're not free, even if you think you can make your new laws. So this business of negative voice, of being able to squash somebody else's position, I think has a through line in the copyright story. And the example this week is in Missouri, there's a senatorial campaign, and a woman named Carnhart is running in and used a 30-second clip from a Fox News show in one of her ads. And Fox has gone after her for copyright infringement and has suppressed the ad. Actually, it's now back up. They've gone after, they've sued her for infringement. Damages are significant in this realm. They've asked the judge to not only take it down, but to confiscate any donations made to the campaign based on this ad. So this is a tremendous misuse of the copyright law. And I think this will probably be thrown out and laughed out of court. But the fact is that in political campaigns, things move very quickly. And people have learned, again, you incentivize many things when you give the monopoly privilege. And people have learned to use Digital Millennium Copyright Act takedown notices and other forms of copyright enforcement to silence speech in political debate. They did this in the 2008 election. Fox tried to stop McCain from using part of his own speech in an ad. It's nuts. In terms of what I'm trying to do in this book, I would say part of the lack of dignified conversation is that there's a lot of misuse of these powers.
Yes, here and then there.
Here comes the microphone.
One other example about the use of political ads is, I believe, in Nevada, senator, no, not Reed, Engel, the candidate, tried to sue Reed for using a clip of her saying something silly.
Can I just tell you one thing, which is in the when during the Revolutionary War, the British made chamber pots with Ben Franklin's face on the bottom of them. So every time you had to relieve yourself, it was Ben Franklin. So this would not stand anymore because we now have the right to protect our image. But people were not as concerned about their image. Franklin had no legal backing to prevent these chamber pots.
My question is, it sounded as though some of what you were saying about the common rights and use of predecessors to express oneself would be very useful for some 19 and 20-year-olds I've talked to in college who really had a hard time with plagiarism and the need to write.
So I'll talk
not
a tiny
copy
bit
from
about
the internet.
That. Yeah. So it's important to make a distinction between plagiarism and copyright infringement. They are really completely different categories. Plagiarism is using somebody else's work and claiming it's your own. And you could do this with Shakespeare. You could do it with Plutarch. You could do it with anybody. So whereas copyright infringement is a statutory tort, where you've used somebody to make money or something without their permission. And but plagiarism, to deepen this a tiny bit, this is an ethical question. In certain communities in which you say, look, as in this community, you don't do this because the rules of the game here are we're interested in you coming up with your own ideas and taking credit for them and so forth. That's and if you're pretending somebody else's ideas are yours, you're not playing the game we're trying to play here. So at my college, we kick kids out if they plagiarize, and I support that. But it's not true of all communities that plagiarism is considered wrong. And the example I give in the book, which was a great surprise to me, is the law community in this country. Judges plagiarize regularly from the briefs that lawyers submit to them. The Supreme Court judges plagiarize. That is, they cut and paste verbatim quotations from briefs submitted. And the idea here is that, in fact, the law is not about personhood. The law is not about who said this. The law is about making a cogent argument based on the facts and the standing law. And if a judge sees a well-written brief and wants to use it, they can. So there's never been a successful plagiarism complaint in the law. And it makes a nice example because you would think, well, if anybody would be against plagiarism, it would be lawyers. But in fact, no. The fellow who taught me this, he said, I knew I was a lawyer when a judge quoted me without attribution. That's how you become a lawyer.
Because we're in a public library, it's worth remembering that the very right to a library was adjudicated all the way to the Supreme Court, the notion that you had the right to share a book with somebody else that had not purchased it. And today, with the incredible proliferation of online content that is just making staggering amounts of stuff available, we now have this thing called the iPad, which not only makes these things wonderfully available, but also eliminates the possibility of being able to share something that you bought with someone else. This immediate consequence of this will be the destruction of the industry of used textbooks in academia. I'm more concerned about whether this is has very serious consequences for the whole notion what copyright really can be when it comes to the written and even the video word.
Yeah. You know, I don't. I'm shy of trying to predict things because this stuff.
Wait a minute. That's going to be the next thing we do.
Is predict something.
Yeah, Lewis is going to show you what the world will look like 50 years from now. That's what we're going to end with.
It'll be a moment of silence. So what you're describing is what is called the first sale doctrine, which is written in law and is the fact that you can, if you buy this book, you can do almost anything with it except crank out more copies of it. That you're not allowed to do. But under first sale, you can loan it, you can read it 1,000 times, you can give it to your kids, you can sell it. You can do whatever you want. The owner's control stops at the point of sale, so there's a downstream commons of the ownership of the book you've bought, and the internet has, as with everything else, thrown this into great turmoil. Because if you buy one copy of something and post it on the internet, you've destroyed the market for everything. So it's not clear that the first sale doctrine could work in cyberspace. That said, what's replacing, you know, first sale is governed by other pieces of the Copyright Act, such that you have fair use rights and that you can use things without permission that you haven't paid for and so forth under certain circumstances. All of this is changing the main thing that's happening in the internet economy on this is that copyright is being replaced by contract, in which when you get something, you click, you think you're just getting past that damn screen, but you're signing a contract which sets up different protocols of ownership than were the normal ones under copyright. How this is going to play out is anybody's guess. I mean, the one thing that when I first heard about this, somebody said, "Well, you know, first sale doctrine. People now think that's actually about market failure. The only reason we couldn't charge you every time you read the book was it was hard for us to see that. But now that we can have a market there." And if you read it aloud to your kids, that's, you know, a 10-cent up charge. And, so maybe first sale is just market failure.
Lewis, would you, as we wind up, we'll have a book signing in a moment. Oh, somebody's right there.
Desperate to ask a question?
Yes, you know, please, this is urgent.
I just wondered if you could talk about the controversy around David Shields' book, Reality Hunger, a little bit.
No, I can't. Okay. I know that book a bit, but not well enough to say anything that would help this audience, I'm sorry to say.
Would you talk about your own books? These three large books, I'm leaving out the poetry and these things, but just these three major books, would you, if there was a a line you would draw that really links them? To me, I want to...
Well, Peter wants to see them as being historically situated, that The Gift is a sort of 70s, early 80s book, and The Trickster book is 90s with tricky people in the White House or something. And this is... My own sense of this is, who knows where The Gift book came from. That came out of my youth. And I remember when I was done writing it, I said to my wife, I can never write another book. I've strip mined my youth. it's an idealistic book. It's a book in which, in a sense, you know, I had come up as somebody who got interested in poetry and writing. And all my siblings had, you know, proper careers. I have a brother who's a doctor, and one is a computer scientist, and one is a nurse, and one is a business. You know, and I thought, well, you know, I hope they can send me checks because I'm going to be a poet. with the audacity of youth, I thought, well, I'll just write a book that'll change the world, and that'll be the way I get out of this problem. And it didn't do that, while you're reading it, you feel a little bit better. So,
and you feel the world changing.
The Trickster book actually does have a connection to The Gift book, and The Gift book at the beginning says, now there's certain problems with the gift exchange, which I'm not going to talk about, and I just never talk about them. And one of them is, there always is, typically there is a gift community. You know, there's people who exchange gifts, and this is wonderful if you're in the community, but it's not if you're outside. And so, for example, if all the scientists swap their data, but it's just the guys and you're a woman scientist, it doesn't look like such a great gift exchange thing. So, in the gift book, there's a little digression talking about Ezra Pound, and I end up talking about Hermes, the Greek liar, cheat, thief, god of the roads, and so forth. And when I was done with the gift book, I thought, well, the Hermes material is somehow the thing I was trying to avoid talking about. So, and there's a wonderful moment in this old story about Hermes. He's born, he makes a lyre out of the turtle, the musical instrument, and then he steals Apollo's cattle and stuff. And he comes home after stealing these cattle, and his mother is, you know, you're a bad kid. And he says to her, you know, I want honors from my father Zeus, and if he won't give them to me, I'm going to steal them. And that's the hinge between these two books, between the question of, so what happens if you are outside the system, or in some way the system itself is not sufficiently lively to support you? How then does the imagination work? And so that book is an exploration of sort of disruptive imagination of the, you know, all the situations in which somehow the cosmos needs to be, either have its joints moved around or else destroyed and reborn.
And as you say about Prometheus in the new book, you know, if the gods are going to be stingy, then you've got to steal the fire.
Yeah, it was always confusing to me why the gods wouldn't give us the things we need. It seems so weird. And then I figured out, actually, I mean, it took me 10 years to figure this out, but the answer is there really is a significant difference between heaven and earth. And... if you want that difference to be maintained, you can't have true gift exchange. What you need is thieves who can cross that boundary. And so the thieving is a way of maintaining difference and still having commerce. It's the sacred thief, though. It's not just the guy who mugs you on the sidewalk. And in a way, this book goes back to the gift book. I mean, it's more the social side of thinking, again, how do we think of ourselves as creative selves, and what are our obligations to our talents? But this case in a somewhat more politicized and, American current cultural argument.
And turning all this founding fathers crap around and getting to a place that we might want to arrive at again one day. The book is really... visionary and a kind of amazing blueprint of something that's shared, and at the same time really, really fine thinking about ways we have to be very specific to protect certain things and ways in which the only way to protect something is to let it go. Thank you, Lewis. Hi.
Thank you, Peter.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujakji Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and public television station KCET. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.